Hey, fellow foodies. Have I told you just how much I love doing this show lately? It's been so much fun to explore super cool ingredients and chat with these amazing, interesting people that are working at the forefront of food research, especially when they're looking at food through the lens of many different disciplines. This episode was no exception. My lab's research takes me on so many cool journeys, both geographic and intellectual in nature, and it gives me the chance to read broadly in the field of natural product studies and to meet folks that are working on the chemistry of life from many different angles. I'm stoked to have Dr. Laura Sanchez on the show today. She's dialing in on Skype from Chicago, where she's an assistant professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the University of Illinois Chicago. Laura's work leverages some really fascinating techniques in chemistry to investigate molecular networking pathways between organisms. She uses analytical mass spectrometry to elucidate the chemistry by which cells and microbes communicate with one another or even with their surroundings in order to coordinate biological functions in complex backgrounds. And she's doing this with a super cool model system. She's actually using Bailey-Hazen blue cheese, which is a rind cheese, to look at these communication pathways. So before we jump into the interview, I want to take a closer look at exactly how cheese is made. The main ingredient, of course, is milk. While most of you are likely familiar with cheese made from cow's milk, there are actually many other dairy sources used in making cheese across the globe. And this includes milk from sheep, goats, buffalo, camels, yak, and even reindeer. The animal source of the milk and the type of food that the animal grazes on can also impact the final flavor of the cheese product. Sometimes, different types of milk are blended in the cheesemaking process, and it's not uncommon to see blends of cow and sheep milk in cheesemaking. Now, milk itself is actually an emulsion of milk fat globules that are floating in a watery liquid, which also contains milk sugar, or lactose, proteins, minerals, and vitamins. Milk contains casein and whey, both of which are proteins. Casein is the most important to the cheese-making process. Milk is transformed into cheese through the process of curdling. Historically, this was achieved by obtaining rennet, which is an enzyme derived from the animal's stomach. Today, though, most commercial cheesemakers use a rennet that is produced by microbes that have been genetically engineered to make it. The rennet enzymes work by shaving down the hairs that surround the casein micelles. These hairs are what prevent the casein from sticking together and forming clumps. So once they are removed, it is then possible for these proteins to clump together to form the actual cheese curd. In addition to the rennet, a starter culture of bacteria is also added to the milk to start the breakdown of the milk sugar, or lactose, into lactic acid. And this is achieved using lactic acid fermenting bacteria. As a result of this process, the milk protein, or casein, is curdled, and the whey protein, which appears as a thin, watery liquid, is left behind. Next, that liquid whey is removed from the cheese curds, and then salt is added to the curds, which are then also cut up into smaller pieces and heated in order to release more of that liquid whey. The casein clumps, or the cheese curds, are then pressed into a mold to form a shape, and this is how we get the cheese wheel. Now, once it's been shaped and that liquid has been removed from the casein clumps, then it's time for the aging process to be initiated. And this is where microbes actually play a leading role in altering the final flavor, texture, and even the color of the cheese product. Historically, some cheeses were aged in caves, and within those cave environments, you had different microbes that naturally occurred in those caves that would play a role in the aging process. Today, however, in commercial cheese production, a more closely controlled process that involves exposure of the cheese to specific microbes or even specific microbe blends is used. Non-starter lactobacilli bacteria can drive lactic acid type fermentation in the cheese, and these are especially important in the aging of cheddar cheese. Whereas penicillium molds, or fungi, play a role in other types of cheese. Take, for example, Penicillium camemberti, which is used in the ripening process for camembert cheese, which my kids also call stinky cheese. And you also have Penicillium roqueforti, which is used to create blue cheeses. Cheese making today is truly an art form that integrates modern tools of microbiology to drive the process from raw materials to a final value-added product. The aging process is also incredibly complex on a microscopic level, especially when you consider the role of interkingdom signaling underway between fungi and bacteria that are responsible for the cheese ripening process. And this is where Dr. Sanchez's cutting-edge work in tracking the chemical dialogue between species comes into play. She's using a type of blue cheese as a model system for understanding how microbes from distant branches of the tree of life can network together. So thanks so much, Laura, for coming on the show. It was great seeing you really just a few weeks ago, I guess, in Madison at the Pharmacognosy meeting.
Yep.
So why don't we begin by you giving us a little bit of background on why you chose Bailey Hayes and blue cheese as a model system for your research.
Sure. So we actually have our collaborators at UC San Diego, Rachel Dutton and Ben Wolf at Tufts, actually sampled 165 different wheels of cheese across the world. And what we found was that the natural rind blue cheese, such as Bailey Hayes and Blue, is actually one of the most reproducible cheeses across the world. And so I think that was a nice place for us to start the research, just because we had a really good handle on it as a model system. And Bailey Hayes and Blue is great because it has both bacteria and fungi, so we know a lot about how it's made. So the blue that you find in those blue cheeses is Penicillium roqueforti, so we know a lot about that. On the inside of the cheese, and then on the outside of the cheese, we know the most about this one with its reproducibility from both the bacteria and the fungi. So we're able to reconstitute all the microbes that should be found on it over the 2-month aging period. And it's delicious.
Oh, cool. So yeah. when you speak about reproducibility, do you mean that there are certain cheeses that aren't as easy to reproduce depending on their climate or where they're being aged? Does the environment have a lot to do with how cheeses age or taste?
Yeah, so there are some that are really specialized. So there's one, like, for instance, that's wrapped in alpine bark.
Cool.
Or like willow bark. Yeah, so that one, it's, I think, since it has more of an environmental factor, it's not quite as easy for us to bin into a certain category. So the other reproducible cheeses are like washed rind cheeses. So the ones that are like really like almost feet stinky and they're like the really gooey slimy ones. Those are covered in like ocean bacteria. Yeah. So you typically find like Halomonas, Pseudoalteromonas, Psychrobacter and Vibrios. And then the other one are like the bloomy rind cheeses, so like Camembert and Brie, are all really reproducible. And some of the other ones, they just get a lot more specialized, I think, in like how they're produced. Like, you know, there's some where there's like cow milk from like, that's only ever in like a bucket in like one place in the world. Like that's not as easy to bin.
Yeah.
But these natural rind cheeses are like, they fall into a nice category. So I think they're the most ideal model if you're going to try to make, if you're going to try to study something that you think might be driving microbial communities.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I like to tell people it was Bailey Hayes and Blue was once served at a White House dinner. So it's like on the official menu. So President Obama ate my science project.
That's great. Very cool. So are you actually making this cheese in your lab, or are you buying it and studying? Like, what are you guys doing in the lab with the cheese?
Yeah, so we actually have Bailey Hayes and Blue is made by Jasper Hills, and they worked really closely with Rachel when she was out at Harvard during her Bauer Fellowship. And so a lot of the strains we have in the lab were derived from rinds that they sampled there. So we don't make the cheese, but we do get the cheese curds from cheesemakers. So we're using real starting materials. Uh-huh. We actually grow all of the microbes on cheese curd agar. So we take the actual curds that are used in the cheese making process that these bacteria would like to grow on, and then flash freeze them and grind them up. So it just becomes a powder. And that's what we actually throw in and make with the media, in addition to 10% salt. So cheese starts out really salty.
Yeah, so that promotes the growth of those lactobacilli, right? The lactic acid fermenting bacteria?
Yeah, so we actually don't grow those very often. Oh, so we're more dealing, so those are important in the actual cheese making process, mm-hmm. like how you get to the point where there's curds in the whey. And then we're really only looking at the bacteria that grows on the rind. So in these natural rind cheeses or these aged cheeses, it's the bacteria that takes over, or the bacteria and fungi that take over, like over a 2-month period.
Wow.
So yeah, the lactobacilli that's used in the fermentation is pretty much all gone in most cheeses in about 7 days.
Interesting. I didn't know that. And so, yeah. Well, before we jump into the chemistry, I've got one kind of funny question. Does your lab totally smell like blue cheese? Like on an average day, what does it smell like in there?
Sometimes, but I think when the cheese curd plates are being made, it just smells like we're having a fondue party.
Oh, awesome.
Because it's all really molten. It's weird because I'm like hungry sometimes now, and it's so it's not a normal lab, thought.
That smell, yeah. And so, and before we dive into the chemistry, I think it would be helpful to kind of explain what your major technique is, or the major tool that you use is mass spectrometry. I think that many people have been introduced to mass spectrometry for the first time through like TV shows, like CSI, where you put the sample into the machine and it magically spits out an answer of what the compound is. Is it really that simple, or how does mass spectrometry work?
Yeah, so I think in addition to CSI, the most common place you encounter a mass spec on your day-to-day life is at the airport. So when they swab your hands, they're basically putting that into an ion mobility mass spectrometer. When they do the little swipey thing.
Yeah, that I get swiped every single time. Like yeah. I'm a magnet for it.
Me too. We must look suspicious, but. Yeah, that's like the time you run into mass spec on like a day-to-day basis, I think.
Okay.
So it can be very simple. And, when you think about, to me, when I think about molecules, we know that molecules are made of elements. So you might remember elements from the periodic table. And then molecules are just, when you put them together, they're all these elements, and all these elements have a very specific weight. And then mass spectrometry is just a way for us to really precisely measure that weight. So it's
you're
like
weighing really tiny things that are found in very tiny amounts in different materials, basically.
Yeah, it's like the world's most expensive scale.
That's great.
Yeah, so it's just a way for us to really precisely and accurately measure the weights of these small, small, abundant, but very specific molecules that you might find in across samples.
And so what happens when you have a sample that maybe you have two different things that weigh the same amount? How do you distinguish between those two?
Yeah, so that happens a lot in nature and in life, that certain things are really either close in mass or they can't be distinguished by just taking the weight as it is. And so we do another experiment called it's called tandem mass spectrometry. And basically the way I think about tandem mass spectrometry is that these molecules are like puzzles. And if you extend this analogy and you think about like a child taking a puzzle and throwing it against the wall, the puzzle is going to break apart into its pieces. So energy has been applied. And so I think about these molecules like puzzles. And when you apply energy, they break apart in a really specific way. Mm-hmm. And so that's the other way we can tell things that essentially look similar apart. So even though they might be really similar, the way they break apart is really dictated by how they're put together. So like it's almost like the picture on the puzzle, and that helps us put it back together. And it's kind of like solving a really complex Sudoku puzzle.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like a 1,000-piece puzzle.
That's great. Yeah. Well, and so once you're able to kind of, you have your full weight of whatever molecule you're looking at, you have the fragmented weight, and then do you basically, can you check those against databases, or do you build your own database, or how do you kind of track these molecules that you'd expect to find in your cheese?
Yeah, so historically, you know, when you're looking at microbial extracts, there are a lot of good databases, but we've actually found with the cheese, it's kind of it wasn't as well known as we thought it would be at the start of the project. So even though these bacteria are and fungi are really similar to things we do know about, they look like they have really different abilities to produce different molecules. So some of the things we can really easily find in a database, and then others are just totally unknown. And
so you're actually possibly finding new chemicals that have never been reported before?
Yeah. And so, I think a lot of that could be how it's grown. So most people don't, like casein, like the high amount of casein and the high amount of salt and lipids in this system is a really different kind of like starting materials than most other bacteria are grown on. So I think part of that also might be dictating what we're able to find.
And so one of the things that's always fascinated me about chemical ecology and natural products are how some microbes can behave differently when they're alone versus when they're with other species. Have you observed that in your cheese system? Do they produce different compounds in different scenarios?
Definitely. So we find that the co-cultures, so we've started out with the system. We originally wanted to go in and reproduce communities, and we can definitely grow bacteria and fungi together in a community like you would find on the cheese. But it ended up becoming really difficult to figure out who was making what. So we kind of backed off, and we're doing these co-cultures now where we're pitting bacteria against bacteria or bacteria against fungi. And what we found so far is the bacteria, so like the fungi don't really care as much about who they're next to, but the bacteria are really responsive to the different fungi. So we have about like 8 of our favorite fungi that we've cultured and isolated from the cheeses, and we've pitted them against all the 2 kinds of bacteria. And across some of the bacteria, there's definitely conserved responses depending on the type of fungi.
Cool. So when you say like conserved responses, are you talking about the chemicals that the bacteria are producing in response to the fungi, or is that what you're tracking?
So we actually track it in collaboration with Rachel Dutton's lab. So she's done a lot of RNA-seq and created transposon mutants where different genes are knocked out.
Can you back up a second and just say, what is RNA-seq?
So RNA-seq is when we're looking at specific, like the readout for specific genetic mechanisms. So with RNA-seq, these big data sets can kind of be like generalized to say, what are all the genes related to protein synthesis doing? Or so we can kind of like group conserved biological functions using RNA-seq. And then the transposon mutants are when you insert a genetic element into a non-essential gene that is supposed to knock it out or knock it down or inactivate it. So it kind of tells us when we look at the fitness from the normal versus the transposon insertion, like what becomes essential in that condition.
Okay, cool.
And so from the genetic standpoint, we find that, and what you might expect is certain things are always conserved, like export pumps for antibiotics, or...
these are like basic functions that keep the organism alive are the ones that they usually always have?
Yeah. And we find that depending on which kinds of fungi you put next to it, whether it's like a Pseudomonas, like that's a natural rind-growing partner, or an E. coli, which is like a cheese invader, you get the same response.
Okay, cool. And so you're looking at how the genetic elements that are at play, you're looking at the chemical elements. And I guess one question bringing this, you know, full circle back to food and the quality of the food is, do these different, if you have different bacteria or different fungi in your cheese, does that influence the flavor or texture of the cheese? And You know, how much variety or variability have you seen in that so far?
Yeah, so I think this kind of falls back on the kind of cheese. So I kind of think about when they're making cheese, these big cheese wheels become self-selecting auger plates. So like the washed rind cheeses get washed periodically with the sterile brine solution. Mm-hmm. So I think the outside ends up becoming a lot more salty. And that maybe is partially how it selects for those like ocean-loving, like ocean-like bacteria. And so the bacteria definitely do influence the flavor and the taste, but I think part of the cheese-making process also helps select for those for that reason, although I don't think it's ever been thought of that way.
Okay, cool.
Until recently, yeah.
And so what you're doing really with, you know, with cheese is you're modeling a system where you have inner kingdom signaling, right? So mm-hmm. you have bacteria and fungi. So can you elaborate on that a little bit more, and why is that important to the larger picture of science?
Yeah, so I think a lot of, you know, when you think about a lot of these microbiomes that, like, you know, the microbiome is very hot right now, and we don't know, you know, we have these really now great lists of inventories as to what kinds of species are there. But I think generally when you think about a whole microbiome, the fungi are often ignored, even though they're like arguably a lot more easy to culture. Mm-hmm. And so I think the cool thing with this research is that, you know, we're able to take a whole very simple microbiome and dissect it. And I think what we've really started to see is that you need both the bacteria and the fungi. And so I think it's been a really nice way to show that, you know, bacteria, everything is important, but like if you only study one part of it, you're really missing the bigger picture.
Yeah. Because
these bacteria are very responsive. So I think it's really like a lot of the initial fungal metabolites are really driving and impacting the bacteria and how they form and interact over time.
Very cool. Yeah, I think this kind of research is super applicable also to the plant kingdom. When I think about everything that's happening with signaling in the rhizosphere underground between plants and bacteria and fungi and even nematodes, and there's just so much going on in nature that we haven't really paid close enough attention to. So I think this is an awesome way to start network analysis and modeling of those very complex systems.
Yeah, and I think the cool thing with the cheese too is that we're able to go, you know, when we find things in these co-cultures, we're able then to just go directly back to the cheese itself. So, you know, we need a lot more of it, but we can extract the cheese, you know, and actually then try to look for and quantify these molecules that we're finding in the lab on the things people are actually eating.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I guess my last question is, you know, what's the most surprising thing that you and your team and your collaborators, I guess, that you guys have run into in this research? I mean, this is a very innovative kind of project. I'm sure there have been many surprises along the way.
Yeah. I think for me, the biggest one is that we're finding certain classes of molecules are really important. So like, for instance, everybody knows like, or it's, I think it's not everybody knows, but it's, you know, appreciated that the acquisition of iron is really important for how certain bacteria are able to like take hold, like in infection or in an environment. Mm-hmm. And we are finding a lot of these same kind of molecules that are able to historically chelate iron, but we're not finding them bound to iron. We're finding them bound to other metals. So I don't know, like, for instance, we found like a co-proporphyrin, which is kind of like a derivative of heme bound to zinc. And zinc is, you know, part of a cow feed additive and it changes seasonally. And so even though these molecules technically have affinity for both metals, we're only ever finding them bound to certain ones. And so I think to me, this opens up bigger questions into, you know, everybody's been so focused on iron. I think there's a whole nother I don't know if we fully understand what trace metals do in systems. And so we've been able to use the readout for like weighing these really specific molecules to kind of start to point us in that direction. So I think it, and you know, Rachel's gone back or Ben has gone back and they've looked to see like is zinc acquisition, are those genes upregulated? And they totally matched all the physical data.
Oh, so, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's things, you know, sometimes as scientists, we tend to cherry pick a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that can really, sometimes it like veers you in the totally wrong direction. And so I think, you know, if you stop kind of cherry picking and just like take the data as the data, then you start going down these really unexpected roads, which are really fun.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Laura, for coming on the show. And I hope someday to visit your lab and get a, I don't know if I want to taste the experiment, but I'll definitely smell it.
Oh, we definitely do cheese tasting with whatever's left over.
That's great. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much. I hope you enjoyed this special episode of Foodie Pharmacology. I've learned so much from speaking with Laura and finding out more about the cool chemistry and microbiology that goes into making and aging cheese. I encourage you to visit sanchezlab.science to learn more about her fascinating work. You can also follow Laura on Twitter at Dr. Laura Sanchez or DrLauraSanchez to get updates on this research and other projects underway in her lab. As for me, I think I'm going to take a snack break and enjoy a plate of cheese and crackers now. Next time on Foodie Pharmacology, we're going to investigate one of my favorite fall treats, the apple. The center of origin for apples is in Central Asia, and though we only see a relative few varieties of apples in commercial circulation today, more than 7,500 varieties that differ in flavor, color, tartness, and texture have actually been developed across the globe. The big question, of course, is, can an apple a day really keep the doctor away? Tune in next time to Foodie Pharmacology to find out. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. We need your help in spreading the word. If you like the show, it would be amazing if you could leave a review on one or more of our podcast platforms like iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also find me on our Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page, on Twitter and Instagram at my Quave Ethnobot account, spelled Quaveethnobot. I'll see you next time.